Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. Today, we're talking with legendary free speech advocate and lawyer Robert Korn Revere, who's representing the controversial website Backpage.com, which has been charged with and cleared of charges that it operates the world's largest online brothel. Last December in California, a court ruled in Backpage's favor against the state attorney's general, who's now the junior senator from California, Kamala Harris, who tried to say the online advertising service was guilty of pimping. Just a few days ago, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal by three women who claimed they were sold into sexual slavery via Backpage. The top court's action essentially means that Backpage's providing a place for adult ads is legal. But now, in the wake of U.S. Senate hearings by the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations that focused on alleged sex trafficking of minors at Backpage, the service has shuttered its adult section. This is a story that is ongoing. It involves free speech, government overreach, and the future of expression and free speech on the internet and beyond. Bob Korn Revere, welcome.
Nick, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the charges that were dismissed in California last December. What was the service or that Backpage offered, and who was using it?
Well, Backpage provides an online platform for classified advertising, like Craigslist. Craigslist is the largest, Backpage is the second largest. It offers ads in various categories that you'd normally expect to see classified ads, including automotive, job seeking, and so on. But it also, until recently, had an adult services section, as Craigslist had had before 2010. And so the argument was made that because it accepted third-party content, that is, ads posted by individuals out there, that it was responsible for the content of those ads, notwithstanding the fact that it had terms of service which prohibited posting for illegal activity.
Right. So, I mean, whether or not people who posted to the service ended up engaging in prostitution, Backpage said, you know, you can't openly advertise for that type of behavior here or anything like that. But talk a little bit about the law that governs why an internet service provider or a website is not responsible for if it creates a marketplace and then people start that the publisher of a website or the internet service provider is not responsible for the content that gets posted on those kinds of sites.
Sure, happy to do so. This goes back to the early days of the internet, when it became evident right away that the volume of material that could be posted by everyone out there who has access is so large that those who serve as the internet intermediaries, that is, those who are the platforms for that third-party speech, cannot be held responsible for the speech posted by those third parties. There was some early case law development in the early 1990s that suggested that people might be responsible, particularly if they took some steps to try and edit content. And so Congress, when it was adopting a rewrite of the Telecommunications Act, added a provision as part of the Communications Decency Act that immunized online platforms for content posted by other people. And that's known as Section 230. It is the section that really protects all online intermediaries, whether it is Google or Facebook or Backpage.com.
Or websites like Reason, when we have comment sections, and we're not responsible for what people post in the comment section.
That's right.
So is that type of immunity for a publisher, is that different than what happens in kind of meat space? So if a newspaper if a newspaper in the classified sections, you know, and the same thing, I mean, Backpage was created by a couple people who had experience at the Village Voice and New Times and whatnot. I mean, alt weeklies that were famous for escort ads. Is there a different set of laws that governs a newspaper publisher and a website?
There is, because the presumption had been that in the brick and mortar world, that there's more ability to verify content. That was one of the things that Section 230 changed, and it was done with the express point that free speech could not flourish online if everyone had to verify the millions and millions of postings. I mean, think about it. Google has 1.9 billion users. There are millions and millions of posts on Google every minute. And if you hold an online intermediary that passes through third-party content responsible for that, then the default position would have to be to censor anything that raises a question. And so when Congress was adopting Section 230, it expressly made the decision to treat that online content differently. And that's one of the reasons, and almost inadvertently, but yeah, one of the reasons why the internet has flourished as a medium for global communications.
Yeah, let's talk about the unintended consequences here, because, you know, this was in 1996. It was part of the Communications
right.
Decency Act. The Clinton administration, Attorney General Janet Reno, Bill Clinton, the Republican Congress at the time, they all expressed grave anxiety and fear about the internet. And they were
sure.
trying to regulate it. And they actually were, it seemed to be they were moving towards in the direction of regulating the internet as kind of like another broadcast network for radio or TV. So how did this come out that, I mean, they, you know, at the same moment that they were trying to shut down things, they actually opened up the internet in a way that is pretty spectacular.
Well, therein lies the irony for a piece of legislation that people still call the Communications Decency Act as being a measure that really preserved internet freedom. As I mentioned earlier, it almost came about by accident because this was part of an amendment to a major overhaul to the Communications Act. This was part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And well into the process, Senator James Exon from Nebraska came up with this brainchild called the Communications Decency Act. And its intent was to regulate the internet like broadcasting, that is, to apply the George Carlin 7 dirty words indecency standard to all internet speech. Imagine that.
Yeah.
There
would literally be, you know, maybe 10% of internet content left.
if that.
Yeah.
And everybody would have to be very, very careful with anything they said in their email. And so the section that we're talking about, Section 230, came along as a proposed alternative to this blanket prohibition of indecent speech online. And the idea was that we were going to, or at least this was a proposal by Congressman Chris Cox, we should overrule those precedents that say that online intermediaries are responsible for third-party content, and we should rely on their ability to decide what to allow and what not to allow, the so-called Good Samaritan provision, so that if online intermediaries make choices about what to permit on their platforms and what not to permit on their platforms, they are not going to be held legally responsible for that. Now, Congress couldn't bring itself not to adopt the Exxon part of the Communications Decency Act, and Congress being Congress said, oh, let's just adopt both of them. And so we ended up with both provisions under the overall rubric of the Communications Decency Act. Fortunately, the Exxon part, the prohibition on indecency, was struck down a year later in the landmark decision of Reno versus ACLU. And it marks the first time the Supreme Court has ever looked at a new communications technology and given it full First Amendment protection. So it's very historic for that purpose. But it also is highly historic because it created the internet that we have today that is free expression in its natural state. Now, what was left over after the Supreme Court decision was the Section 230 part that protects internet intermediaries, and it became an even greater engine for promoting free expression online so that intermediaries could feel free without the risk of liability of posting speech posted by third parties.
Can we talk a little bit about indecency? I mean, indecency,
sure.
which, you know, when you said that it's the first time that the Supreme Court or the government actually gave more or full First Amendment protection to a new media or medium, you know, obviously that didn't happen with radio and broadcast TV because there was
That's
this
right.
idea that there was scarcity. You know, there could only be a limited number of stations. So the government would regulate this under the FCC, and they would regulate not only you know, your place on the spectrum, but also what was being said and done. Is there even such a thing legally as indecency? Because that's, I mean, it's a real, I mean, if pornography is only something you know when you see it, indecency is even more feels over reels.
Yeah, it's never been much of a legal standard, although the FCC still has a mandate mm-hmm. to regulate indecent speech in radio and television, and it is still on the books. They still do enforce those provisions occasionally.
The last big cases were they revolved around things like Janet Jackson's having her nipple exposed during a Super Bowl halftime, Cher and Bono of U2 having fleeting expletives on
live award shows. That's right. And there have been a few things since then, but mostly during the past few years, the FCC has tried to retreat from any over-enforcement, although it has strong-armed some broadcasters behind the scenes over the indecency rules. So they are still pernicious. The standard still exists to the extent you can call it a standard. And you contrasted it earlier with obscenity. Obscenity always had its problems. As Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart right. famously said, I can't intelligibly define it, but I know it when I see it.
And what is
about
what
Potter
is,
Stewart?
Oh yes, go ahead.
Well, funny thing about that is that Potter Stewart dissented from the decision when the Supreme Court looked at the indecency standard. Apparently, he didn't know indecency when he saw it.
I was going to say also that when he was talking about pornography, he was talking about the horrible French movie that isn't even softcore pornography called The Lovers or like Les Amants or something,
right.
which is just a dull kind of adult movie from the mid-60s. It's amazing.
Well, keep in mind, the kinds of things that happened both culturally and legally between the mid-1950s and the mid-1970s can't be underestimated. I mean, the culture changed by leaps and bounds. The law really changed with it. I mean, in the 50s, and to a certain extent in the early 60s, we were still talking about censoring novels,
right.
let alone
Ulysses, Lady Chatterley's
or,
Lover, Tropic of Cancer. I mean, it is
exactly.
unfathomable.
Or Lenny Bruce in his,
yeah.
in his comedy routines,
right.
convicted of obscenity in 1964 in New York, of all places.
I think he should have been convicted of not being funny, but I realize that's a minority position, especially among First Amendment advocates.
Hey, man, he's an icon.
Yes, yes. And like all icons, he's kind of stiff and wooden and not particularly funny, but
you're
no,
just
it,
not a child of the 50s.
it is something. I mean, there are you're born on one side of a cultural revolution, and it's hard to recapture just how repressed and stultifying expression was up until like you were saying, really until the 70s.
Exactly, and it was in the early 1970s that the Supreme Court finally came up with a definition of obscenity that it thought it could use, and it's been in place since 1973. It has changed over time in its application because society has changed and because it is at least in name. Geared toward contemporary community standards, and
right.
so that presumably changes over time. But largely, it's just the fact that society has changed and the standards of enforcing the law have changed along with it. Indecency, not so much. And
right.
when it was devised by the FCC in the mid-1970s as a standard, it was really devised as just some way of coming up with obscenity light. What can we put together in a form of words that isn't as rigorous as the obscenity test, but something that will apply something different to the world of broadcasting? And it's been sort of a Band-Aid that has existed ever since. The Supreme Court looked at it in 1978, said the standard was close enough for government work. It has recurred as a legal issue periodically. About every 7 or 8 years, we have an outbreak of mm-hmm. some kind of moral outrage that leads to some cases. And then most recently, we had the Super Bowl case and the cases involving the music award shows. Still, the Supreme Court in 2012 could not bring itself to overturn the standard, but reversed the FCC on due process grounds.
Right. Although then the FCC also, and we won't go into this today, they started monkeying around with net neutrality as a way of kind of, instead of fighting a war or fighting a battle, they were going to win the war by kind of changing the way that the internet operates. But that's a conversation for a different day.
Exactly.
Talk about Backpage, though, here, because, yeah. You know, one of the things that is, you know, you talk about irony on the same day that the Supreme Court or in the same week that the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal, meaning that Backpage was within its legal rights to offer adult ads. Senate subcommittee hearings on Backpage in being involved in the trafficking of minors for sexual purposes started, and Backpage pulled its adult section, as you mentioned, like Craigslist had done 6 years ago. What in the Senate report, what is the smoking gun that they have that somehow Backpage really is just, you know, this online not just an online brothel, but an underage online brothel?
Well, I mean, the short answer to your question is that there was no smoking gun, and that the report is really just a series of concoctions based on misreadings of what the terms of use for Backpage included. But there was a lot in your question there before getting to that I'd like to unpack, because sure. As you mentioned, there was the Supreme Court decision denying review in a case from the First Circuit in which Backpage successfully invoked Section 230 of the Communications Decency mm-hmm. Act. And the same day as that decision, Backpage decided to close its adult section, as Craigslist had in 2010 when it was under pressure from the National Association of Attorneys General. First of all, with the Section 230 decision, and this goes back to our earlier part of the discussion, talking about the prosecution in California. Out there, essentially, the argument had been made by, and the charges had been brought by the Attorney General based on the notion that these ads posted by third parties on Backpage should be the subject of a criminal complaint against Backpage, that in essence, mm-hmm. making Backpage responsible for the content of those ads. That charge was based on affidavits that essentially really only said that when Backpage got ads, it really did apply its terms of use. And right. when it got complaints about ads possibly containing illegal content, it took them down. It was really a remarkable document in the charging document.
So, yeah, so they were saying that Backpage is actually responsible because it looked at and it edited or turned back ads that actually were, you know, trafficking in illegal or seemingly illegal behavior.
Yeah. And ultimately, the court looked at all of the materials, even allowed the state to supplement its filings, and then on December 9th, issued an order throwing out the charges, saying that Section 230 did implement First Amendment standards and that the Attorney General lacked the authority to bring the charges against Backpage under that provision. Interestingly, then Attorney General Harris had joined with the National Association of Attorneys General in an earlier letter a few years ago complaining about Section 230, saying that they lacked any authority to bring such a criminal prosecution. But that fact apparently didn't dissuade Attorney General Harris from turning around and then filing exactly the charges that she knew were barred by federal law. Fortunately, the court understood what the law was and threw out the charges. And yet, again, on December 23rd, before she left office to join the Senate, Attorney General Harris essentially refiled the same charges against Backpage.com. So there is this ongoing pressure. And that led to that, not just that one specific thing, but a series of those kinds of continuing pressures led Backpage on January 10th to – or January 9th, I'm sorry, to make the decision to close down its adult section as Craigslist had done in 2010.
So who – let me ask you a more normative question, you know, and from a devil's advocate position. So Backpage, like Craigslist before it, and alt weeklies, which are kind of going belly up anyway, like, you know, they people escorts can't advertise for sex, you know, and under with a wink, wink and a nod, nod under, you know, people pretending to be teenagers selling sexual services can't advertise openly. Who loses by that kind of clampdown, whether it's through, you know, actual censorship or through this kind of imposition and kind of bleeding to death of commercial enterprises?
Well, you know, as I say, anyone who wants to communicate using that medium is the loser because it gets closed down. Although, you know, as you know, John Gilmore, who was one of the pioneers of the Internet, said long ago, the Internet treats censorship like system damage and routes around it. Trying to ban something like that simply is not effective on the Internet. But one of the losers in all of this are people who actually are trafficked, because Backpage had a history of cooperating with law enforcement when they got any kind of information about minors being trafficked. They have maintained a database of the kinds of accolades they've gotten from law enforcement at all levels, from the FBI to the Department of Homeland Security to local law enforcement, praising them for their cooperation. And since the shutdown last week, we're beginning to see some indications that law enforcement is not all that happy with the fact that grandstanding senators led to this shutdown. Just yesterday, I saw a news story reported by an NBC affiliate that quotes the Henrico County prosecutor, Mike Feinmill, as saying that this is really going to hurt our efforts in law enforcement. And he says of Backpage, they comply with our court orders. They give us information. They have witnesses who come and testify in court, and they assist a great deal in law enforcement. And that's the sort of thing that is lost when you have these kinds of pressure tactics being used to close down a website.
I'll add also that the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, or for Investigations, it's a real bipartisan deal. Rob Portman is the Republican. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri is the Democrat, the ranking Democrat on it, and they're both guns out with this. How do they respond to that kind of commentary from law enforcement? Do they just brush it aside, or
they don't respond to it? That, I mean, that's not the point of these kinds of show trials.
Yeah. What is the at this point? What kind of legal exposure does do the CEOs or the heads of Backpage have? Because there were times where they were taken off of airplanes, or when they were changing planes in the U.S. and arrested for this kind of stuff.
That was when the first California charges were brought. As I mentioned, they have been refiled, and so that legal battle will continue, and we're confident that it'll lead to the same result as before. There is the ongoing litigation in Chicago involving Sheriff Dart. And here's another example of sort of the counterproductivity of all this. Dart has for years made a career out of campaigning against online classified sites. In 2009, he sued Craigslist for aiding and abetting prostitution. That charge case was thrown out by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, saying that by definition, these websites cannot aid and abet prostitution. They are conduits for third-party speech. That didn't deter Dart, because in 2015, he sent letters to the credit card companies urging them not to do business with Backpage.com, and hinting broadly that they could be culpable if they continued to do business. And within 24 hours of that letter, the credit card companies capitulated and stopped doing business. Backpage brought a civil rights action against Sheriff Dart, and the district court, while it granted a temporary restraining order, did not grant a preliminary injunction. But that was quickly reversed by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in a very biting opinion written by Judge Richard Posner.
So is this, I mean, I guess it's a sign of progress that censors no longer openly call themselves that. And instead, you know, they say they're doing this for the children or for, you know, society at large, or they're not censoring speech at all. What they're doing is, you know, they're just making it clear to businesses what kind of business, you know, what kind of Visa and MasterCard or PayPal, oh, look at who you're helping. Is that the new form, that kind of speech regulation or regulation of expression is taking more and more, that it's actually about going after commercial activity as such?
Yeah, I mean, it is what we were facing, but it's nothing new.
Right.
I mean, these tactics are really as old as the hills, and they go back to the days of Anthony Comstock, who became the nation's chief censor in the 1870s. And in fact, the federal law prohibiting obscenity in the mails bore his name. It was known as the Comstock Act, which, by the way, is still on the books. He pioneered this notion of doing it just for the children. Actually, everything that he did really set the playbook for the way censors operate today. The one difference was that back then, before the days of public relations and before we had a developed First Amendment jurisprudence, it was no badge of shame to be a censor.
Right.
People like Comstock embraced the notion with some gusto, and it was only as the law developed and we began to have the kinds of free speech protections that we do that it became more of a shameful thing, so that you now have people who do the very same activity saying, but this isn't censorship. I'm not a censor. I'm just doing this or that, and I'm only going after, say, commercial activities or
things
like that.
Why is commercial speech so much more suspect than so-called political speech? This happens all of the time where there are actual restrictions that are upheld, legal restrictions on commercial speech that don't pertain to political speech. Why do we hate commerce?
Depends. Well, first of all, we need to be a little bit clear about what we mean by commercial speech, because there is speech that is done for profit, like selling a book, selling a newspaper, making a movie, whatever. That's not commercial speech in the legal context of the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and it is fully protected. I mean, the New York Times is the essence of protected speech in any newspaper or pamphlet or book, even if you sell it for a profit. Commercial speech that proposes a commercial transaction, that is, say, an advertisement, is protected speech, or at least it has been since the mid-1970s in Supreme Court law, but receives some lesser measure of protection. It receives sort of an intermediate level scrutiny as opposed to what we think of as strict scrutiny in First Amendment terms. And one of the reasons for that is because of the possibility of fraudulent activity. Because of that possibility, that's one reason. And another is that the Supreme Court has said that commercial speech is hardier there will be more of an interest in promoting your interests as a commercial speaker.
Well, as a final topic of conversation, we have a new administration coming to town. Do you expect, and this goes back to questions about the FCC, certainly, but in other areas, Donald Trump has said early on, he said, hey, you know what, I'm going to open up those libel laws. He has talked about talking to Bill Gates, of all people, to shut down parts of the internet that, Islamic jihadists are taking over. Should we be Jeff Sessions does not seem to be his attorney general does not seem to be the type of guy who will wrap himself in a flag and burn it. I believe he's against flag burning as an act of political expression. Should we be worried, especially under a Trump administration, about free speech and First Amendment issues?
It's really hard to say. I don't know if makes sense to be more worried than it is for any incoming administration, because all of them tend to be fairly hostile to First Amendment values. What is interesting is that there has been far more discussion this year of what the implication of the Trump administration is for the First Amendment and for free expression. I think it's always a useful thing to explore, but had the election gone the other way and had Hillary Clinton been elected president, then I think we would have an equal number of concerns.
But we would have less conversation, probably, even though she has said exactly the same things as Donald Trump and went after. She doesn't even like free political speech, right? She's still against Citizens United.
Well, that's right. And had pledged to appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Citizens United. And, for those people who argue that, political speech should receive the highest level of protection, it seems more than a little ironic that they would propose a law that could make engaging in political speech a federal felony.
Right.
But that's
well,
really
do you have a sense, and I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure or displeasure of dealing with Donald Trump in a business or a situation or litigation,
not.
But, you know, he's a loudmouth from New York, and I say that as someone who was born in Brooklyn and lived and worked in Manhattan and, you know, grew up in New Jersey. I know loudmouths. I mean, it almost seems insane that somebody like that would actually get worked up over, you know, bad words on TV or anything. But I guess stranger things have happened.
Well, he's a politician now, mm-hmm. so anything is possible. I think all bets are off in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I think what makes this year so unusual is that I can't remember an election. Maybe you can, but I can't remember any time in which both major party candidates made as part of their campaigns pledges to chip away at the First Amendment. You know, with Hillary, it was the Citizens United issue, right. And I'm sure there are a number of other fairly recent.
Well, she also, literally the same weekend that Trump talked about talking to Bill Gates about shutting down the internet, she said the same thing about shutting down parts of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a popular thing. And like Bill Gates controls the internet.
Yes, but, no, I mean, that's one of the problems. Yeah,
I know. Well, and that's the problem, too. I mean, Trump campaigned talking about opening up the libel laws and going after journalists who say nasty things about him. Mm-hmm. He talked about, as you say, closing down the internet. And, you know, the difference between Trump and Hillary is that I think Trump didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about.
Right.
Whereas I think Hillary did know what she was talking about when she pledged to appoint Supreme Court justices who would change First Amendment law. Both of them are famously personally hostile to the exercise of free speech by other people about them.
Right.
And so both of them I saw as really negative forces in whether or not First Amendment would be preserved. I think there's another element, too, and that is whether or not the Trump administration, in approaching the business of the press and the daily exercise of journalism, will be so hostile that that could have a dampening force. Mm. And as you mentioned, Sessions as Attorney General is not anticipated to be particularly First Amendment friendly. So all of those factors are in play, and they're great unknowns. But on a comparative basis, it's really hard to say which administration would have been more difficult to deal with when it comes to free expression.
So I guess this is just one more reason why we should be glad that only one of them could win. Well, as a final thought, are you optimistic? You mentioned the great John Gilmore quote about, you know, the internet senses censorship as kind of like a damaged sector and it routes around it. Are you optimistic? Is it technology that drives free expression? How much of it is, you know, how much of it is the reality of the internet and of decentralized communication possibilities, and how much of it is the mindset, a large public mindset that almost conjures the ability to route around censorship?
Well, I am optimistic, both in terms of how technology has changed things, and I'm also optimistic about the law. I think the law of free expression has moved in a positive direction. It's not inevitable that it will continue to do so, but those of us who fight those fights at least are doing so in the belief that we can make a difference and hope to keep that trend going in the right direction. But I think, you know, it's important to understand the limits of what John Gilmore said. I think it is true that censors cannot stop speech on the internet, but they can stop speakers, and they can exert pressure on speakers and entities that transmit the speech of others. That was the lesson that we just learned with Backpage, that those kinds of pressures, legal or not, can make a difference. And to the extent that great numbers of people use online intermediaries and social media, if pressure can be brought to bear on them, then that can make a significant difference in what information people have access to. And that goes back to the point earlier, too, that not everything is governed by straight legal decisions. This is a tactic that's been used for decades, if not longer, of where the law blocks censors will try and find a way to use extra legal means. Mm. They will have commissions, or they will have permanent subcommittees on investigation, have onerous information demands, which is what the issue was before the PSI subcommittee, before this previous hearing. And by the way, that matter is still in court, it's going to be resolved by the United States Court of Appeals, by the D.C. Circuit.
And that just means that they were saying, okay, Backpage, you got to give us everything, every communication that could possibly have, every document, every email that might be relevant?
Well, that's right. I mean, essentially what PSI was seeking with their subpoena to Backpage was every document touching on any editorial decision for a six-year period.
Yeah. And of course, I in looking through the commission's report or the subcommittee's report, it's also funny that they at various points complained about having too much material to go through.
And the material that they expressly said they did not want was all the information about Backpage's cooperation with law enforcement.
Yeah. Wow. This is obviously it's an issue that isn't finished yet either for Backpage or the larger question of free expression in a digital, in a post-digital age, because the internet is the backdrop against all of this. I mean, now we're debating other means of limiting expression or empowering it. So I want to thank you, Robert Korn Revere, who represents Backpage and is a stalwart defender of free expression under all circumstances. Bob, thanks for talking to Reason today.
Nick, always a pleasure.
For Reason, I am Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Never miss an episode. Rate and review us while you're there. Let us know how we're doing. Thanks for listening.